Today's broadcast was originally recorded on July 9th, 2025.
Are you still talking about Jeffrey Epstein? This guy's been talked about for years. I can't believe you're asking a question on Epstein at a time like this, where we're having some of the greatest success and also tragedy.
Weird, but okay. He's showing a little bit of discipline. That's nice.
The only question is, will I gold leaf the corners? You could maybe tell me my cabinet could take a vote. You see the top line moldings, because you can't paint it. If you paint it, it won't look good, because they've never found a paint that looks like gold. So painting it is easy, but it won't look right. And the question is whether or not we should gold leaf it. Who would gold leaf it? Could I raise you? How about, would you gold leaf it?
Oh, well. I'm glad we didn't waste time on Epstein. We got gold leaf to talk about.
I don't know why I came here tonight.
Jeez.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Good golly. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internets around the country and the world. Blanketing planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Desi Doyen, the only question I have is, should we use some gold leaf around the corners of this studio? I don't want to waste time. We got a big show, but let's talk about that for 20 minutes, shall we?
Interior design, very important for the president to spend his time on.
You may have already heard some of the sound bites from Trump's so-called stupid cabinet meeting. Really, the latest episode, I guess, of Donald Trump's weird cabinet theater meeting. Is that maybe the way to call a cabinet meeting theater?
Yes.
Don't know what to call it.
That's the right thing to
call
it.
Where his cabinet members pretend to have a meeting, but really they're just there to say nice things about Donald Trump in front of the cameras, and Trump, as usual, adds a whole bunch of stupidity and fresh lies on top of existing ones. It's not actually a real cabinet meeting at all. That's not how those things work. But if you heard stuff from that cabinet meeting, it was probably some of what we just played there at the top of the show, where Trump was suddenly strangely defensive about any discussion regarding Jeffrey Epstein for some reason. Sort of claiming, well, that's a waste of time. How dare you bring up such issues when we've got such important things to discuss, before he then went on to spend all kinds of time, and we just played a part of it there, discussing how he personally picked out portraits. He calls them pictures. Portraits for the cabinet room there, and discussing whether he should gold leaf the ceiling or not.
Droning on and on and on.
But
and
there was
on.
A whole bunch of false claims that he made for the camera, as usual. And I got to say, God bless CNN's Daniel Dale for still having the stomach after all of these years to try and document and correct them. As he noted last night at CNN, Trump's remarks at the White House included, quote, inaccurate assertions about inflation, immigration, his tariff policy, the massive domestic policy bill he signed last week, China's use of wind energy, U.S. and European aid to Ukraine, the U.S. relationship with South Korea, and other subjects. So no time to talk about Epstein, but plenty of time to talk about gold leaf and lies about all of those things I just mentioned. And while I got a guest standing by and some other reality-based stuff that we need to get to, I do want to take a minute or two to lean on Dan Dale here to at least try to offer a few reality-based fact checks to a few of Trump's most egregious lies in front of the cameras on Tuesday at that pretend cabinet meeting. As he has repeatedly, Trump falsely claimed Tuesday, quote, we have no inflation, observed Dan Dale, writing that, in fact, the U.S. does have inflation, an inflation rate of 2.5% as of May, which is actually an uptick from a 2.3 annual rate in April. It is not, quote, no inflation, as Trump insisted, and it's pretty much around what it was when Biden left office, if about a half a percent down from that. That rate is, by the way, expected to increase once Trump's tariffs take full hold in the months ahead, if they ever do. Trump has also repeatedly claimed, as he did again on Tuesday, that his so-called big, beautiful bill, his massive tax and spending package signed into law last week, would wholly eliminate taxes on Social Security benefits. In fact, as Dale notes, the White House itself has already acknowledged to CNN that millions of Social Security recipients above the age of 65 will, in fact, continue to pay taxes on their benefits, and that while some who are making less than $75,000 a year will receive an additional $6,000 tax deduction if they need it, if they use the standard deduction, that measure, unlike most of the tax cuts for the wealthy and the corporations that are in this bill, will actually expire in 3 years.
Oh, so it's a temporary one.
It's a temporary one that only some people can use. It is not a no tax on Social Security provision. There is no such provision in the bill. And yes, it's a temporary gimmick that's in there while, you know, many of the other tax cuts are, in fact, permanent ones. Trump further suggested that letters that he recently sent to foreign leaders about new tariffs, new tariff rates, that those are equivalent to, quote, a deal. That's what he meant by a deal. Remember when Trump and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, after Trump's initial massive tariff announcement back in April in the Rose Garden on what he described as Liberation Day, remember when they all said that the White House will be making dozens, if not hundreds, of trade deals with foreign nations within just the next week or two? They'll be coming very, very soon based on those tariffs. Well, turns out those deals never came. Who could guess? And as Dan Dale notes, it's just not true, unquote, that Trump sending a formal letter telling foreign nations what tariffs will be on goods imported from their nations to the U.S., that is the same as a so-called deal. Even though the White House is trying to cover their asses now by claiming, see, look, those are the deals that Donald Trump, the great deal maker, that's what he was talking about. He's made deals with all of these nations by sending them letters telling them how much tariffs are going to be charged, not against them, but against Americans who will have to pay those tariffs when their goods are imported to the U.S. The president falsely repeated, as he has for years, that other countries other than U.S. consumers will foot the bill for those levies. And I can't believe that we're still doing this, but if Trump levies a 20% tax on goods from other nations, that means that 20% of the cost of those goods, when they come here, an additional cost must be paid by people here in the U.S., by the importer in the U.S., who subsequently passes on that to the consumer. Got it? He falsely claimed, yet again, that unnamed foreign countries, quote, released their insane asylum population into our country, while, as Dale notes, even Trump's own presidential campaign could not produce any evidence for that frequent claim, which he has repeated for years, and that the best explanation, frankly, that I've heard for him even making that claim is that at some point he did not understand the difference between migrants who claim asylum here in the U.S. and insane asylums. He thought they were the same thing or something. But, you know, once he makes a mistake, there is never any rolling it back when it's Donald Trump. He's got to spend the rest of his life. We all have to stick with it for the rest of our
for the rest
lives.
Of our days.
Yes. He's got to keep making that same claim, no matter how much of a lie it is. Trump further claimed that South Korea convinced his predecessor, Joe Biden, to let the country discontinue payments that help fund the U.S. military presence in South Korea. In fact, as Dale notes, that the Biden administration actually negotiated a spending increase. However, you know, an actual deal, in case you're wondering what they look like, a spending increase which led South Korea to pay more than it did during Trump's first term. Trump asserted that, quote, smart countries do not use wind and solar energy, repeating his recent false claim that China, the world's biggest manufacturer of wind turbines, barely uses such equipment itself, wrongly claiming, quote, they don't have a lot of wind farms, which is wildly untrue. In reality, China is the world leader in the generation of wind power, and it has massive wind farms onshore and offshore, and continues to install additional wind capacity far faster than the U.S.
Yeah, and it's an improvement, though, because he was saying, I don't know, just 2 weeks ago or so, that China had no wind farms.
On Tuesday, the president also lied about California's power grid out here producing, quote, blackouts and brownouts every week, unquote, which Dale debunked with an emailed statement from Daniel Villasenor, a spokesperson for California Governor Gavin Newsom, who notes, quote, the state has not experienced any rotating outages since 2020, and in the last 3 years, no so-called flex alerts calling on customers to conserve power during heat waves, etc. Since 2020, there have been no flex alerts even issued. He said, quote, not only has our grid been increasingly resilient, it's also cleaner than ever. He notes the quote, clean energy provided for 100% of demand on our grid here in California for at least some part of the day, 167 out of the first 180 days of the year. That, of course, thanks to the state's expansion of clean renewable energy and upgrades to our power grid of the sort that Trump has just gutted in his spending bill in order to help pay for tax cuts to rich people. So that's just a few of the lies that Trump told on Tuesday at his so-called cabinet meeting and the independently verifiable truth about them. In the meantime, speaking of clean energy and the need to move to it as quickly as possible and move off of the burning of fossil fuels causing global warming climate chaos, we seem to be seeing it now in real time here in the U.S. Last Friday, it was devastating flash flooding in Texas that, as we go to air today, has resulted in at least 119 people officially confirmed dead, including 36 children who were attending summer camp on the Guadalupe River, which rose 25 feet in less than an hour. 173 individuals are still reported as missing statewide, though that number could, in fact, be much higher. 2 days after that, on Sunday, we saw record flooding in North Carolina as Tropical Storm Chantal came ashore, killing six people across three counties, most of whom were killed by flash flooding. And just 2 days after that, on Tuesday this week, flash flooding in New Mexico has now led to houses being swept off their foundations, causing the death so far of three individuals, including two children. That was very early in that disaster, which saw flooding and mudslides in the southeastern part of the state near Ruidoso, which had recently been burned thanks to climate change-fueled wildfires.
Yes, unfortunately, it's the long tail of disaster continuing to serve up more disaster.
And sort of a double whammy for the folks in New Mexico today. We got a lot of listeners up in New Mexico. Please stay safe up there. Also, Chicago, what was it, 4 months of rain?
It was 5 inches of rain in a very specific localized area of western Chicago. 5 inches of rain in 90 minutes. It submerged cars.
So not even counting Chicago, three massive deadly storms in less than a week, or as the Fox News weather site headline accurately, if somewhat misleadingly, described, quote, deadly walls of water pummel communities across three states in just 1 week, spawn unprecedented devastation. So that is true. The headline is true. But like the full article itself detailing those three storms, it completely fails to mention the one thing that all of those storms have in common, which, of course, yes, is climate change. And we would expect that from Fox News, which continues to pretend climate change and I guess the climate chaos in its wake. All of that's just some sort of a big hoax. Who knew? Just bad luck. But I don't watch a lot of corporate TV news coverage, so I'm not sure if it is even the dots are being connected to climate even any better on real news outlets. Do you have any sense of that, Des?
I have a bit on CNN and on CBS News. They have been connecting it, but I have not watched everybody, so I can't say for sure. But I can say some of the broadcast outlets are connecting the dots, and most of the press outlets are too.
Good. How could they not? Three devastating, deadly storms in less than a week.
Well, if you're Fox News, if you talk about climate change, then you have to admit that you've got to do something about it.
Ah, good point. So as long as they don't mention it, they just cover the devastation. It's devastation. But, you know, what caused it? Bad luck. Thoughts and prayers, everyone. By the way, both summer heat waves and hurricane season are just getting started this year. All of that kicking off in Texas on Friday, on the very same day that Donald Trump signed a bill that gutted landmark legislation to actually do something about climate change. All right, speaking of climate change and the dumb, dangerous stuff in the Trump Republican spending bill, we've been covering a lot of the top line stuff for a while now, both before and after it was signed. But as our friend Ryan Cooper from the American Prospect notes, there's a lot more dumb and dangerous stuff hidden in that bill, which has not been covered as much, if at all, that you may want to know about. He joins us next on the broadcast to explain things like the provision that incentivizes food stamp fraud, yes, the spaceport sweetener, and yes, the mass shooter subsidy. Really, all of that and more straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com. We have been trying to detail over the last several weeks, if not longer, all of the horrible stuff that's in the in Donald Trump and the congressional Republicans' so-called One Big Beautiful Bill that Trump signed into law on the 4th of July. By now, you're hopefully familiar with the top-line descriptions of what's in the bill, what it will do, including cut more than $1 trillion from Medicaid and food nutrition assistance via SNAP, resulting in tens of millions of low-income, disabled, or elderly Americans losing access to health care or healthy food or both over the next 10 years. Similarly gutted, arguably more so, landmark climate and clean energy initiatives, many of which had led to a manufacturing boom in the U.S. in recent years, as instituted by Joe Biden and the Democrats. And as we discussed in detail on yesterday's program with TPM's Josh Kavinsky, military and specifically our immigration, deportation, and detention infrastructure has now been supersized to the point where ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, now has a budget larger than many full armies of other nations. The measure robs from the poor to help pay for massive tax cuts for the already wealthy to the tune of some $4 trillion. If you are in the top 20% of Americans by wealth, you are going to do even better thanks to Trump's bill. Everyone else, however, will likely lose money and or access to other resources, all while this new law adopted without a single Democratic vote by Republicans in Congress who used to pretend to care about deficit spending, at least when Democrats are in charge, will actually raise the national debt by more than $3 trillion. That's the top line stuff that you may have hopefully already heard about. But as our friends Ryan Cooper and David Dayen over at the American Prospect, which has offered some of the very best reporting on the critical details of this horrible legislation as it has been working its way through Congress in recent weeks and months, the nearly 1,000-page bill also includes a whole lot of other stuff which has not received enough public attention, including some bizarre stuff that one wonders if Donald Trump even knows about. That said, it's unclear that he actually understands the top line stuff either, so who knows? But some of these items you probably should know about, even if he doesn't. For example, what Cooper and Dayen describe as the mass shooter subsidy. Yeah. If only so that when all of this comes back to bite us all, you will know who should actually be held to account for it. Joining us now to discuss some of those provisions, some of which they describe as bizarre things hidden in Trump's big, beautiful bill, is Ryan Cooper, managing editor of the American Prospect and author of How Are You Going to Pay for That? Smart Answers to the Dumbest Question in Politics. Ryan Cooper, sir, welcome back to the broadcast, my friend.
Glad to be here.
So before we get to some of these lesser known dumb and terrible things in the Trump Republican bill, which is now the law of the land, given the now triple climate disasters over just the past week, including deadly flash flooding in Texas on Friday and North Carolina on Sunday, New Mexico on Tuesday, not to mention more than 5 inches of rain in 90 minutes in Chicago yesterday. You wrote a piece last month, Ryan, at The Prospect, headlined "Climate Change Will Bankrupt the Country," citing the fact that climate-fueled disasters have cost America almost $1 trillion over the last year alone, which is a remarkable 3% of our total GDP over the past year, and as you report, far more than economists had predicted by this point. So without getting too much into the economist weeds here, how much worse is that than previously predicted by the economists, including one Nobel Economic Prize winner that you cite? And I guess how much worse than that can we expect things to become now that Trump has gutted so much of the landmark Joe Biden renewable energy and climate initiatives from the Inflation Reduction Act?
Yeah, so the economist you reference is William Nordhaus, who won the economics Nobel for his economic model, the DICE model, which estimates, you know, it's like a sort of integrated assessment model where they try to calculate the damage that climate change will cause and therefore an optimal trajectory of emissions, optimal in the sense of like not reducing GDP. And what his model predicts at 1.47 degrees Celsius of warming, which is about where we are right now, according to, you know, NASA and so forth, would be a 0.5% GDP hit. And instead, we're seeing six times that much in just 1 year. Now, you know, some caveats are in order because, you know, extreme weather events are, you know, by definition, rare and random. This is just one country, not the entire world. But, you know, that is so far outside of the range of what you would expect. Sixfold error at a small, relatively low degree of warming, you know, compared to what could happen.
And not just that we would expect, by the way, Ryan, this is what the Nobel Prize winning economist told us to expect, told us that we would be looking at a half a point of GDP versus 3%.
Yeah. Yeah. 3 points of GDP. And, you know, I critiqued his, you know, as a non-economist, as a mere, you know, ink-stained wretch journalist, I critiqued his, you know, model, not on the basis of economics per se, though I did have a lot to say about that, but about the risk that, you know, he would have us take, which is to say that, you know, you're making this model and you're, you know, accounting for, you know, he would let emissions get up to where the concentration of carbon dioxide would be like 650 parts per million. We're currently at like 450 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And warming would peak at, you know, 3.5 degrees. And if he turns out to be wrong, then, you know, we've drowned all sorts of people in Texas and Florida will be under the ocean and so on and so forth. Whereas if he turns out we you know, take more steps to fight climate change on a prudential basis, just in case, then like, what's our problem? Well, maybe we built more solar panels than strictly we needed. Like, that's not the biggest deal in the world, right? Not compared to, you know, whole communities being swept away by torrential downpours that are quite obviously fueled by climate change. This is one of the things that all the climate models predict is going to happen more and more frequently. Mm-hmm. And it will accelerate, you know, in a nonlinear fashion, probably, because, you know, it's these sort of systems aren't, it's not like, you know, 2 degrees will be exactly twice as bad as 1 degree. Mm-hmm. It'll be more, you know, these things tend to interact with each other. The mm-hmm. warming atmosphere can hold more water, and disruptive weather events, mm-hmm. Disruptive weather patterns tend to make storms slow down sometimes. And that's where you get the really deadly downpours. We have like a big, fat, heavy storm that just like runs into a, you know, turbulent zone in the atmosphere and just sits. Mm-hmm. You saw this with like Hurricane Harvey back in, what was it, 2017, where it just sits and just dumps a huge amount of rain in a very short time on a singular spot. And so, yeah, you know, this is exactly what I thought was we were risking to happen. And now we're seeing that it's actually probably even worse than I thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. Another, it wasn't just all economists, I should add. You know, this guy got the Nobel, and I think that was a signal, you know, from the sort of like center of gravity of the economics profession. But other economists, you know, above all, Marty Weitzman at Harvard, who's unfortunately passed away some years ago, he made exactly the same argument that I did, that like, you know, we're talking, this should be about risk management, not about, you know, optimal GDP trajectories, you know, because you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, and meantime, God forbid you build a better, cleaner world for nothing. That's kind of what, and yet, by the way, despite the direct cost of infrastructure repair caused by climate change, and you detail a lot of it in your piece, and the related increases to especially things like home insurance rates for all Americans in the bargain, costing us $1 trillion over the past year alone, what would the response be now if, you know, Democrats started demanding $1 trillion in spending over each of the next few years to safeguard against this kind of damage before it happens, before it costs us that much and more in blood and treasure?
Yeah, this is the real irony of what's happening here, because it so happens that President Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, you know, which was just climate policy for the most part, was expected to cost about $1 trillion. It was about $1 trillion in spending over 10 years, not over 1 year, but big policy. And the result, the economic analysis now indicates that repealing that and replacing it with coal subsidies and whatnot isn't going to boost GDP. It's going to make it, it's going to reduce it. It's going to hurt economic growth, because it turns out now that solar panels and batteries and so on have gotten so cheap that this is actually the best way to drive economic growth. So we're literally cutting off our nose to spite our face. We're allowing China to monopolize the industries of the 21st century, while, you know, the American auto industry is going to be stranded using obsolete technology while China takes over the rest of the world with dirt cheap electric vehicles.
Yep.
And it's, you know, so much for America first, you know. But on the the economic point, you know, that he assumes Nordhaus and the rest of the models that are built on these sort of neoclassical assumptions just assumes that climate policy must be a drag on GDP,
right,
in the form of a carbon tax. But it turns out, no, you can do it in a way that boosts growth and provides more jobs, more production. And it's just completely senseless in a way that's almost impossible to describe what Republicans have done to America and to the American economy and the world, too.
Yeah, even in the best case scenario, we've heard Republicans and climate deniers over the past few years, even in the best case scenario where they say, well, yeah, yes, it's happening, but it's too expensive to do anything about it. I need to underscore, Ryan, you mentioned that Joe Biden's landmark climate initiative, which was already, proving positive dividends in a manufacturing boom and everything else, that cost $1 trillion over 10 years. And what we're looking at now is just $1 trillion in damage just from last year alone. And yet, during the course of the GOP debate in Congress over this budget bill, over Trump's budget bill, did you hear any of the so-called Republican fiscal hawks, to your knowledge, demand an expansion of spending on climate and clean energy, since it's cheaper, since it brings back more, rather than gutting of the so far successful Biden initiatives that did end up being signed into law?
No, I'm pretty sure that they didn't mention that once. You know, the whole budgetary discussion was conducted at a level of like tendentious divorce lawyer, analysis. It was, their signature trick was to say that the tax cuts weren't going to cost anything. In fact, they weren't going to drive borrowing at all because they're merely enshrining the current policy that is right now the status quo. And so that you, since you're not making a change, that's not going to cause any borrowing. But of course, these analyses
right.
of how much we're going to borrow is predicated on the current law before mm-hmm. they pass this, which says that the tax cuts are going to expire.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you're going to go with that line of argument, then you'd have to say that borrowing will be, $3 to $5 trillion, depending on your assumptions, more than the previous numbers that everyone relied on,
mm-hmm.
But your point is exactly right. It's your classic kind of a stitch in time saves nine kind of analysis, that it's way cheaper to prevent these disasters from happening than it is to clean up after the fact.
Yep.
You're taking a possibility again where you could have taken money and put it into solar panels and batteries and wind farms and transmission lines and all this stuff that grows the economy, that provides jobs. And instead, you're spending it on replacing infrastructure that's torn to pieces because of a climate disaster.
Yeah.
It's just unquestionably a drag on the economy. And, a lot of these places will probably just end up destroyed permanently. They'll never come back, especially with Trump at the head.
All right. Speaking of climate and clean energy and clean renewable energy or lack thereof, I guess, in this case, one of the 10 bizarre things that you and David Dayen cite as receiving really little or no attention hidden in Trump's new Republican tax cut and spending bill. Trump likes to cite stuff that he claims to be in the bill, like no tax on tips and no tax on Social Security. Even though no tax on Social Security is not even in the bill, people should know. And the no tax on tips has some very serious restrictions to it. But you describe a no tax on oil drillers provision that actually is, for some reason, in there, and that Trump does not mention during his no tax riffs on this bill that exempts domestic oil and gas companies from the corporate alternative minimum tax. What does that mean? And who snuck that into the bill?
Yeah, I mean, this is basically a measure that was intended to prevent corporations from abusing loopholes too much, so that like if you have positive cash flow and profits, then you have to pay at least something.
Mm-hmm.
And this bill exempts domestic oil and gas companies. The guy who got it inserted into the bill will not surprise you to learn it's James Lankford of Oklahoma.
What?
Oklahoma has a ton of oil and gas companies. I mean, it's just a straight up payout to your, you know, campaign contributors. And it's, again, you know, a thing that ties us to a technology that will quickly become obsolete. I think even in the United States within the next 20 or 30 years, you know, just pushing back the EV revolution rather than stopping it entirely, because I think it's completely impossible to stop at this point. It's just going to become so cheap. And so, you know, we're just giving the oil companies another, you know, 5 to 10 years of tax-free profits at the expense of the American people.
So even if they make money, the most profitable industry in the history of civilization, even if they make money, if they drill here in the U.S., they'll be exempt from being taxed on those profits. And that sort of thing we would expect, I suppose, from Republicans at this point. But you and David report that at the last minute, in order to win over Alaska Republican Lisa Murkowski's vote in the Senate, a provision you describe as incentivizing SNAP fraud was added. Explain that one, if you could.
Yeah, so food stamps are a big part of the cuts in the bill. And one of the ways that they cut it is by forcing states to shoulder more of the costs of the program. Previously, like the federal government would cover all the spending on the benefits specifically, but now states will have to handle some of that. And this is a problem, you know, because it was aimed specifically at states that have a high error rate. The SNAP bureaucracy is very complicated and difficult to administer. The rules are very complicated, and so, you know, most states have an error rate of, you know, upwards of 8% or something like that. And Alaska has one of the highest ones, 13%.
What is that? And so, because I had heard this discussed, what does that actually mean in the context of SNAP? What's an error? Meaning you give it to somebody who shouldn't have it? What does that mean?
I'm not familiar with the exact definition, but I believe it would include, you know, basically payments for payments to beneficiaries who aren't eligible, or payments for items that are not eligible under SNAP rules. You know, so that in, you know, the rules can go awry at any level of the bureaucracy, you know, either the payment to the beneficiary. And then I think probably most commonly these grocery stores have to administer this like whole para-bureaucracy where they keep track of which items are eligible and which ones aren't. And they can mess that up because it's complicated and annoying. So anyway, what Murkowski got as a price for her vote was an exemption from the cost sharing for states with the highest error rates above hers, above 13.3%. And so you can, if you have among the highest error rates, you can get an exemption for 2 years from the cost sharing burden. And so what this, it literally incentivizes people to go out and drive up their error rate, you know, call up the grocery stores and be like, start paying for ineligible items quick. You know, add a bunch of, you know, ex felons or something onto your, under the rolls. And, you know, honestly, I hope states start doing that because it would be a great benefit to them.
So the ones who administered it the worst get a gift over the next few years thanks to this bill. And while Republicans are claiming that, oh, their budget bill cuts waste, fraud, and abuse, they're actually incentivizing waste, fraud, and abuse with this for states with this provision. Incredible. Moving on here, because you got a bunch of, you write, one of the vanishingly few American gun regulations that still exists is a tax on silencers, which has existed for almost 100 years, and it sits at $200. Or you write, it did until now, thanks to what you and David describe as the mass shooter subsidy in the Trump GOP spending bill. Tell me about that one, Ryan.
Yeah, so it's just a tax on gun silencers, suppressors, and they repealed the tax, and they also wanted to remove a requirement that silencers are have to be registered but the Senate parliamentarian ruled that out of order. And I think, you know, that this isn't really that big of a deal in itself. You know, silencers aren't really that useful. That's not quite like in the movies where it's almost you can't hear it at all.
Right.
You know, it wouldn't. It's like it's perfectly possible to carry out a mass shooting without one today. But I think it's
well,
just
thank God. Thank God for that, at least. Yeah.
I couldn't decide, by the way, between mass shooter subsidy or a handout to the assassin lobby.
There you go. Yes.
But I think it's just indicative of the Republican, the gun death cult completely taking over the party. I mean, there's no reason to do this. You know, it's just a, any restriction on someone being able to walk into their neighborhood Walmart and pick up, you know, a trunk full of assault weapons to go to their, you know, local baseball game and mm-hmm. commit 20 murders. That's they just can't tolerate it, and they want as many guns as possible in the hands of as many people as possible.
You guys put a chilling coda on that section, writing, anyone on their way to a workplace or schoolyard to do their part to maintain America's number one record of gun massacres could already get a fully automatic bump fire rifle, thanks to the Supreme Court, but now you won't even hear them coming. What is the spaceport sweetener, as you describe it? And I'm wondering, well, tell me what that is first, then I'll ask you my question about it.
Yeah, so, you know, there's currently a provision for cities. They can build airports by issuing tax-exempt bonds. So you set up like a city corporation or something like that, and you can issue bonds mm-hmm. That are exempt from taxation to build the airport. Mm-hmm. And this would basically allow municipalities to do the same thing for a spaceport. We looked around a fair bit to figure out why. And the only confirmation I could see, Bloomberg reported that there's a company called Space Florida that wants this. It's peculiar because, you know, airports are pretty important. Mm-hmm. You know, practically every city of any size has one. Important method of travel, but it's not like you're taking vacations to Mars anytime soon. Obviously, the other potential beneficiary here would be Elon Musk right. with SpaceX. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't find confirmation that he was behind this. He certainly could have been, and I would not be surprised. I just couldn't find confirmation of that.
Because I guess he's one of the few private individuals or companies that actually has a spaceport down in Texas. So we can't tell if this somehow ties to that, allows them to issue bonds to raise money or anything down like that down in Texas?
No. And it has to go through municipality, you know, mm-hmm. so you'd have to partner with a city. Mm-hmm. And Elon Musk already has a whole bunch of spaceports. But yeah, he certainly could do that. You know, and as we recently saw in Texas, he basically presented the legislature with a laundry list of SpaceX handouts, and they yep. passed basically all of them. So, you know, if he wanted it, he certainly has a record of getting what he wants.
Now, you mentioned this a bit, but I want to underscore it, what you describe as handouts for Chinese steel companies. I know that surely, Ryan Cooper, that must not be the case. Donald Trump would never give a handout to the Chinese, much less to their steel companies, right?
You would think China.
Right.
So this it's not the only coal subsidy in the bill. You know, to start with, they're going to open up 4 million acres of federal land at least to coal leasing, and they're going to cut the royalty rate that coal companies have to pay to the government, you know, for like taking the public's coal mm-hmm. from 12.5% to 8%. But as you were saying, there's a subsidy for metallurgical coal specifically. They make it eligible for critical mineral subsidies through 2030. And metallurgical coal is used in blast furnaces to create steel. And of the stuff that's mined in the United States, the vast majority of it is exported to other countries. And this coal, to get the subsidy, it doesn't have to be used domestically. Mm-hmm. So we're literally paying coal companies to export coal, and thereby indirectly subsidizing steel factories in China, India, the Netherlands, Brazil, and a couple of other places to produce dirty coal that you know spews out tons and tons of pollution, including carbon dioxide. You know, Europe and China as well are you know stampeding ahead with green coal technology using electricity instead. So it's just outrageous.
Yeah, we rock, don't we? Now, oddly, by the way, after Trump, you know, spent a lot of time attacking Joe Biden's CHIPS Act, for example, in his in Trump's State of the Union address or whatever we call that, he described it as, quote, a horrible, horrible thing, the CHIPS Act. As it turns out, this new law actually increases what the CHIPS Act does, subsidies essentially for the creation of microchips in the U.S. This bill actually increases the subsidies by about 40%. Really? How did that happen? And does Trump know about it? Frankly, does he know about any of this stuff? Frankly, Ryan?
Yeah. So the tax credits for semiconductor firms for building factories in the U.S. would go up from 25% to 35%. So that's your 40% increase mm-hmm. right there. Mm-hmm. This one, from all the reporting and asking around I did, I couldn't find any rationale for why Trump allowed this to be included in the bill. I don't know why he hates the CHIPS Act, but you know, one of the biggest beneficiaries of this is once again a foreign company, TSMC, the biggest mm-hmm. chip maker in the world. They've got a big fab going up in Arizona, as I recall.
Yep.
And my suspicion is, again, not confirmed, but that Trump just had no idea that that thing was in there. I don't think it's really necessary. You know, it seemed to be working well enough to get Intel and so on and TSMC to actually build these fabs. Mm-hmm. I don't think they needed another, you know, a large bump in the subsidy. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I suppose better that than taking it away while the factories aren't even finished yet, a lot of them.
Yep.
Trump's not a bright guy. I don't think he pays a lot of attention to detail. I don't think he reads, you know, 3,000 page laws into the late hours.
No.
I think he mainly watches television.
And frankly, I think anything that passed, had it been Republicans passing it and he gets to sign it, he would have, you know, trumpeted it as a you know, the greatest victory in the history of man. So good. At least that one didn't get cut. As mentioned earlier, as the bill is set to blow up the national debt by about $3 trillion over the next 10 years, your partner there, David Dayan at the American Prospect, reported recently on the fact that the bill, in addition to cutting about $1 trillion from Medicaid, will also result in the cutting of about $500 billion in Medicare over the next 10 years, starting in October, the start of the fiscal year this year. Medicare, not Medicaid, but Medicare, even though Medicare is not specifically cut in the new bill. Can you quickly explain that? Because I think it's caused a lot of confusion for a lot of folks.
Yeah, so this comes from the statutory Pay-as-you-go Act of 2010. Mm-hmm. This was also called sequestration, mm-hmm. But you know, back from the Obama years,
right?
And it says that if you know legislation adds to the budget deficit, there are mandatory automatic sequestration cuts that take effect unless you add an amendment to this legislation that would, you know, basically suspend it for, some period of time. Mm-hmm. And, Congressional Budget Office sent a letter to the top Democrat on the House Budget Committee, Brendan Boyle. It's just like a mandatory calculation and everything gets, you know, it's just a sort of across the board cut. Mm-hmm. And the Office of Management and Budget would be required to issue an order reducing spending by $330 billion by January 2026. Some things are exempted, like Social Security and some benefits for low-income Americans, but Medicare isn't. And Medicare is, you know, one of the biggest line items in the federal budget. It can only be cut by 4%, but, you know, so you add up 4% of the program over 10 years, and that's $490 billion. And it's unclear why they did this, whether they just forgot to deal with the paygo thing or something else. So trying to do a stealth Medicare cut without anybody noticing.
They could have put in an exemption in the bill saying that this shall not be subject to paygo, and that would have avoided all of this, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly legislatively how you'd have to do it, but yeah, you know, you could pass something through Congress, whether it's an amendment or just a different law or something like that, that would suspend the paygo requirements.
And they can still do it now, but they haven't. And October is coming, the fiscal year is coming. If they don't, if Congress does not pass a fix to this, presumably there will be a $500 billion cut to Medicare, $50 billion next year alone, on top of a $1 trillion cut over the next 10 years to Medicaid and so forth. I mean,
yeah,
nobody's talking about that, but it seems to be the case unless they fix it somehow.
Yeah, unless they fix it or you just get Trump to ignore it like he has with the TikTok ban.
Yeah.
But you would have to get Trump to understand the paygo thing, and I would not rate my chances highly with that. But yeah, it remains to be seen, you know. And these cuts, by the way, could just devastate hospitals. Yep. Across the country.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen already in Nebraska, in Southwest Nebraska, which, you know, mm-hmm. voted for Trump by about 80-90%.
Yep.
Across the whole region of the state. There's already one hospital that's closed. And, you know, the reason is they're looking down the barrel of losing a huge chunk of their insurance base and doing the math. And they're like, well, we've got to close up shop.
Yep.
We can't make the ends meet. And, you know, Medicare cuts are going to have the same effect. And what will happen when a whole bunch of rural hospitals close and hospitals in poorer areas of cities.
Yep.
Is that all those people, a lot of them now newly uninsured, are going to be dumped on the existing hospitals. And then they're going to have to get treatment that's uncompensated, which, you know, hospitals are legally required to provide care to people who are in like emergency illness or injuries. And, you know, a whole bunch of them will probably end up closing. It's just going to be devastating.
Yeah, I think it is. And at least people can, had they read about all of this in the American Prospect, they would have known before it happened, because you guys have been doing a fantastic job of covering this throughout the process of the debate and so forth. Finally, Ryan, I'm short on time here, but I got two quick questions that I want to ask you. You wrote a book titled, How Are You Going to Pay for That? Smart Answers to the Dumbest Question in Politics. So I got a dumb question for you. Now that Republicans have made clear that they apparently do not mind blowing up deficit spending to the tune of $3 trillion in their own spending bill, will any of that prevent them from objecting to increased deficits the next time Democrats have the power to pass their own spending bill?
No. No, they okay. will say the same thing again. You know, they're just utterly dishonest hypocrites on this notion. And this is the big reason why it's the dumbest question in politics, because it's always applied to, you know, Democratic programs to help the American people in some way, and never applied to Republican tax cuts for the rich or to build up, you know, a Gestapo that's better funded than the Russian military.
Yes. And then the other side of that coin, which I think you sort of touch on there, I'm wondering, will Democrats learn the message from Republicans that apparently deficits do not actually matter, which is something it seems like they could have learned already from, you know, George W. Bush, Ronald Reagan, et cetera. But will they take that lesson away to realize that next time they're in control and get to decide what's in the budget?
I'm a little bit curious about that, because the way that Trump is behaving is, I think, starting to threaten the dollar's status as the reserve currency of the world. And that's the thing that's underpinned America's ability to borrow so much. So it may be the case that it would be wise, especially if we're not in a recession, if unemployment is low and you want to pass a new program, you will need to add some compensatory taxes. But I think that, you know, Democrats just need to get over their allergy of raising taxes, especially on the rich. But not only the rich, you know, I think that, you know, the American people in general need to learn that taxes are a way to fund things that otherwise you're going to have to pay for out of pocket.
Yeah.
Stuff like childcare, pre-K, you know, my kid is in daycare. It's a major expense, even in a pretty cheap city. You know, if you're living in like San Diego or something, it can be upwards of like $50,000 a year to have two kids in daycare. And so, thanks to Trump, it may not be possible to put everything on the credit card indefinitely.
Yeah.
With the exception of there being, if there is a recession, that's when you do need to borrow and spend freely.
Right. And of course, every time after Trump last time, after George W. Bush before that, Democrats have to come in and clean up the mess that was left by the Republicans. And so far, at least from what we can figure out about this bill, we may be heading towards that exact same mess again. Ryan Cooper, I got to get out. My thanks to you, sir. You can find his work, of course, at prospect.org. You can follow him on the blue skies at ryanlcooper.com. He's the managing editor of the American Prospect, author of How Are You Guys Going to Pay for That? Smart Answers to the Dumbest Question in Politics, and also the co-host of the Left Anchor podcast, which you can follow at Left Anchor on the social medias. Thanks, Ryan. Always great speaking with you. Look forward to the next time.
My pleasure.
Thank you, sir. Okay, we have got to get out. My thanks again to Desi Doyen, our producer. Thank you, Desiree. And to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. We hope we made it worth your while. If you didn't, you can stop by bradblog.com and let me know about it. Otherwise, you can go to bradblog.com and download all of our shows since the beginning of time for free and share them with folks you know, love, and hate. That is made possible by those of you who hit a donate button while you're there or go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. And by the way, I don't know how long it's going to take, but we are working finally on a much overdue overhaul of bradblog.com coming within the next few, I don't know, weeks, months. We'll see how long it takes, but we could use your support for that as well. So please consider hitting a donate button at bradblog.com today to help us stay on your public airwaves and to bring the Brad Blog into the
21st century.
Yeah, something like that. All right, that's it. Drop me an email on bradcast@bradblog.com. On the social medias, you will find me at The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.